from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on Forum, best-selling novelist Terry McMillan tackles themes of race, feminism, family, and friendship in her newest book, Who Asked You? The novel is written as a series of first-person narratives centered on the struggles of a family matriarch suddenly left in charge of her grandchildren, while also juggling a son in prison, an ill husband, and a job delivering room service at a hotel. We'll talk with Terry McMillan about her new book and how her previous novels, including the blockbusters Waiting to Exhale and How Stella Got Her Groove Back, brought glamorous African-American characters to a wide audience. Join us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Terry McMillan joins us in this Forum hour, a former East Bay resident. She is the author of seven best-selling novels, including Mama, Disappearing Acts, and the novel Waiting to Exhale, which became a motion picture starring Angela Bassett and Whitney Houston, and How Stella Got Her Groove Back, which also became a motion picture starring Angela Bassett and Whoopi Goldberg. She is a recipient of an American Book Award, an NAACP Image Award, and the Essence Lifetime Achievement Award for Excellence in Literature, and her most recent novel is Who Asked You? Terry McMillan joins us for this Forum Hour. Good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Actually, let's talk about the title. I think it has that kind of Who Asked You a little bit, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Who Asked You?
Yeah.
It depends on the day.
Well, it centers around Betty Jean, who is a character going through a lot of troubles. In fact, the kind of vicissitudes that most people probably couldn't necessarily put up with. She's a woman who works in room service. Her husband has Alzheimer's pretty badly at this point in the novel. She's got problems with her kids. One of the kids is a drug addict, dropped two of the kids. I don't want to give too much of the plot away, but dropped two of the kids on her. Another son is in jail. I mean, you know, and you wonder, how does she get through? And she's a really admirable character. That's how she gets through. She's got resilience. She's got toughness. She's a kind of mother figure that obviously you admire.
Well, I think to some extent, a lot of mothers are like this. They are resilient. I mean, everybody's not Donna Reed, and it's not always Leave It to Beaver. People have real problems in this day and age. And this story, of course, started in 2001. But I don't think most people have one problem. It's usually a pile of them. And they're all sometimes connected.
Well, she certainly has a pile of them. And she loves her family. You wonder, in fact, who's to blame? Because she and her husband, Lee David, although we meet him, like I say, in his Alzheimer's state, really good, decent people. They wanted to raise their kids to be good kids, and they've got, you know, these problems. And how much of it is the neighborhood? How much of it is the streets, just from your perspective as a novelist?
I think a lot of it is the streets, or was the streets. Because one of the things that Betty Jean asks herself as the story opens is, you know, how responsible should I feel about how my kids turned out? I thought I tried to do a good job of raising them. And then she starts feeling a little guilty, thinking that maybe there were other things she could have done.
I could have hugged them more, yeah.
Yeah, all that. But the streets, at least for two of them, because one of them he's a chiropractor, and he basically just alienates himself from the family, his community where he grew up and all that. And I think that the tug of the streets gets to a lot of kids at an early age, and I think that's what happened with some of them.
Although, as you say, she thinks maybe I could have yelled less or hugged more or that sort of thing, but that's just kind of her character, really, isn't it?
Yes, but I don't know. I don't know how true that really is because there are so many variables and so many different types of parents. I mean, I'm the oldest of five, and I grew up poor, if you want to call it poor. And my mother went to the 11th grade. She had five kids by the time she was 23. And she just said, you know what, we had to speak correct English, and she knew when we weren't. And she said, you know, all of you little suckers are going to college, so don't even think anything about doing anything else. And for the most part, three of us graduated from college. All five of us entered the doorway. Two didn't finish, but one who didn't is really brilliant. And the other one just wasn't sure what she wanted to do.
Well, Dexter's, he's brilliant. He's pretty smart, though. He's a mm-hmm. jailhouse lawyer and yet, you know, got in prison for a carjacking and, you know, is also trying to, as many of these kids are, essentially take advantage of his mother. You know, well, help me with my parole. I need a place to stay. I need a job. Send me money. All these kinds of things.
I don't think he's taking advantage of her. I think he's just arrogant. And selfish and self-centered. And she calls him out on it.
Yes, she does.
but a lot of them, I mean, you know, I was trying to show that a lot of these people in prison, they're not all dumb. They're not all criminals. Some of them are just stupid. And when they're younger, they make mistakes. And when it's not a violent crime, even though carjacking is considered a violent crime. But when no harm is done to another, inflicted on them, even though I think carjacking falls under a violent act.
His mother, and Betty Jean, a letter back, says, think about what this woman's going through.
Yeah, right? Yeah. She's like, you changed her life. So once you've been violated on any level, you don't forget it. And so that was part of the angst. It was like I wanted to be able to empathize with him, but at the same time call him out, have him be called out on his contradictions and his own behavior, which it takes him a long time to even own up to. And that's what Betty Jean was doing, because she said, we didn't raise you like this to take advantage of anybody. You know, you knew better.
She also calls him out for blaming the racist system and being a black man and all that as the reason he's in jail when he did a carjacking.
Yes. I mean, but that's part of the contradiction. I mean, a lot of people, in some cases, it's true. But sometimes they rely on that as an excuse. But there are a lot of people who are victims of racism who are behind bars. And that's why, to some extent, DNA has come in very, very handy to disprove a lot of people's innocence.
Well, you get into go back to the neighborhood, if we could, for a moment, because, you know, there's a sense that things were more harmonious and maybe better for kids when it was an interracial neighborhood. And there's a sense that white flight and all that affected what happened to the neighborhood. It comes through at least from the characters. And you also have a very strong interracial friendship between Betty Jean and Tammy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, her sisters are kind of a pain in the butt, but, you know, this Tammy is like a sister to her, and she's a white woman. And, you know, that you mix it up there in some ways, showing that perhaps interracial connections are things that can be really viable and work.
Well, of course they can. And that's one reason why, I mean, I did a lot of research. It may not look as though I did, but I did.
I realized you did.
And I studied, I really explored and talked to people who lived in Los Angeles in the late 90s and early 2000, when a lot of these families did coexist. They lived side by side, and it was a lot of different ethnicities. And there were white people that still lived there in the hood, and some of them just didn't leave because they were comfortable there, which I thought was fascinating. And also, you know, I just like the contradictions. The fact that there are two black guys on the one side that are racist and won't speak to her. Then there's Korean on another side who they only deal with Koreans. And then you have this black woman across the street who befriends her. They befriend each other and they trust each other. And they aren't really thinking about who's black, who's white. They just are friends. And I like the the juxtaposition about based on all these different dynamics happening simultaneously. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean, and it's very ambitious in bringing all this together. It's I was particularly impressed with the way you were able to get into the inner life of these characters. I mean, it was almost Faulknerian. You know, you've got like 15 different characters, and you're inside each one of them, including little boy Luther, you know, and characters who are so different and so diverse, really. I mean, is the only word to explain it. We're talking, by the way, with Terry McMillan, whose new book is called Who Asked You? And we're going to talk about the fact, well, she's going to be in Danville tonight at 7 p.m. at Rakestraw Books in Danville. And tomorrow, 6:30, she'll be in Oakland at the Heart and Soul Center of Light for a talk and signing sponsored by Marcus Books. Now, you've been living in L.A. area in Pasadena for a year now. Why'd you leave Bay Area?
I lived in Los Angeles for a year. I don't like Los Angeles. I like Pasadena. I lived in the Bay Area for 25 years. Yeah. And I built a house out in Danville. And then, you know, I got a divorce. And then my son graduated from college. And he was a boomerang kid for a year or so. And then he ultimately moved to Memphis 4 years ago. And he's a guitarist and a pretty good one. And he's a Stanford grad and a smart kid who's now 29.
With a proud mother, obviously.
Yes, I am. But I ended up realizing that I lived in this big house out in Danville, which I was kind of bored anyway. I just wanted to make sure that he had a good childhood, which he did. And I put the house on the market right after everything crashed, the housing market and all that. And it was on the market for 2 years. And I couldn't sell it. So I dropped the price a lot. And my accountants who are in Los Angeles said, Terry, you're throwing good money on bad money. Short, sell it, and get out. I was worried about my credit rating. And so I it took me a while, and I finally gave in. And I wanted to move back to New York, but I collect art. So I had all this art, and I'd given away a lot of furniture. And I hand-dyed bedding, so that's what I'd been doing in my garage. So I had all this art, all this paint, and all kinds of things, and I couldn't go to New York, so it was suggested, how about Los Angeles? And I was like, ew. But it's temporary. So
you got a novel out of it.
I got a novel. It seems that I get a novel everywhere I go. But I like Pasadena.
I was just there this past weekend, officiating at a wedding of my closest boyhood friend. It's very nice.
Pretty and it's civilized.
Put me up at a...
And it's not Hollywood.
Definitely not Hollywood. Put me up at a very nice hotel. In fact, an old hotel, a Huntington Hotel. I got to ask you, though, as long as we're talking about your life and your personal life and everything, just what it was like for you to go through that whole crucible, really. I mean, a lot of people know this story. You were romanced by a guy. It was very public. You married him, and then he turned out to be gay after years of marriage. And there were lawsuits. You were on Oprah. I actually saw that video. A lot of eyeball rolling was going. I mean, you were
the first one.
Yeah, the first one.
Yeah.
I mean, it was. I imagine in many ways invasive of your life, wasn't it, to have all that out there?
Yes, and plus, I didn't know it was. I kind of got tricked when I went on that show the first time, and there were things that Jonathan was saying that was just stupid. And I was, like, really surprised. So that was why the eyeball was rolling. And plus, you know, they always prep you beforehand to let you know what they're going to ask you. I mean, Oprah is notorious for that. They send producers to your house. They let you know far in advance how the show is going to go. And they changed it at the last minute.
Without telling you?
Yes. Or, yeah. So it was much more confrontational. And that's why I was, you know, doing my head like this, and I think I saw...
Can't see you on radio.
I was swinging my head because I was shocked at some of the questions as well as Jonathan's answers. But to be honest with you...
Jonathan being the ex-husband. Yeah.
Yes. You know, I loved him, and he loved me, and I know he did. But when I knew I wanted a divorce because I had gotten bored, and it was just time, you know? To be honest with you, it wasn't until after he knew I was serious that I started noticing a change in his behavior. And I think whatever it was that he had repressed for years, this was an opportunity for him to see who he really was. But during the time we were married, I never, ever, ever got a sense of it. But the bottom line is that I didn't end up hating him or being angry at him because he was gay. That wasn't it at all. You know,
in fact, you take up homophobia in this new book of yours.
Yes, I do. And that was part of what I really resented, that was what I was being accused of. And it was more or less what his lawyer had helped put him up to in terms of trying to dispute the validity of my prenuptial agreement. And it really angered me. That's what I was probably more upset about. And then all these people coming out of the woodworks accusing me of being a homophobe. And I'm saying to myself, you know, how do you think you'd feel if you were married to someone for years and they came out of the closet when you said you wanted a divorce and then they tried to turn around and get your money? But it wasn't just Jonathan. It was his lawyer who put him up to this. And I know how, you know, she has since retired. And I sued her because she was a sleaze. She was a sleaze. And she told him point blank, you can contest any agreement. And my prenuptial agreement was tight. I had Barry Bonds lawyers in the end read it and say, you know, this is a pretty good one, but I'm not stupid. But all this is to say that, you know, I have since befriended him. I forgave him. We talk on the phone, you know, at least once a month or so. And he knows I don't hate him. I was angry for a long time at just how everything, it took a lot out of me. But I found out that my anger was eating me alive. And it wasn't worth it. And plus, I was angry at him for reasons that the public didn't even understand. They thought it was because he was gay, but that really wasn't it. That really wasn't it. I didn't like the idea of being manipulated in public more than anything. And my fame was being used to shred me and to portray me in a wrong light. That's what I was angry about.
Let's talk about your fame. I mean, in some ways, it's been a burden to you.
No. Only in this sense. I just had a review of this book a week or two ago, about 2 weeks ago, in the New York Times, the Daily New York Times, by a woman who I couldn't even believe it. She reviewed four different books by four women. I was the first, if you want to call it a review. And it was a whopping two paragraphs. And the first one she spent talking about me as the queen of commercialism when it comes to fiction. And then she starts talking about my personal life, being married to a gay man who knew all along he was gay. And I'm saying, well, she knows more than I do. And, you know, too bad that my movie, that it turns out that my boy toy, I mean, it was a personal attack on my personality and my lifestyle. And then she talked about too bad all my fans who went out and bought that Stella book and the movie were disappointed. And then she had like a small short paragraph, which wasn't even an accurate synopsis of the story of the book. And I'm saying to myself, how is this possible?
Don't let this anger get to you, would be my advice.
Oh, no, but the bottom line is I'm going to write to the editor, because they have a new editor.
They do have a new editor.
Yeah, I'm going to write to her and this writer, because I found out she has a reputation for doing this. But it was totally unprofessional and almost tabloidish. You know, she didn't review my book. She reviewed my personal life.
What do you feel about, though, this genre that people put you in of being the commercial writer? Because you're a serious writer. Like you say, you do a lot of research and you're a good storyteller. And, like, I enjoyed this book. But then I looked at the cover and it does look, you know, the cover has just big lips on it. And it looks what people would call commercial.
Well, you know, first of all, I don't know. I mean, the story is primarily about people who are always trying to tell you how to live your life when they don't look at their own behavior, their own lives. I mean, a lot of people do that. People who are judgmental, and they offer unsolicited advice, and most of the time it's your family. So I like the cover. And there are so many boring, ethereal book covers. And I don't apologize for the way that I tell a story. But to me, pop fiction, as they call it also, and commercial fiction, I think that people want to punish you if people buy your books in large numbers. And
I think you're right. And I think also, if I may say so, and it started out with your success in writing, you found an audience that people didn't know was an audience that was out there.
Well, I'll put it this way. The other thing I would venture to say, I have to say this, is that, you know, to me, pop fiction, commercial fiction, to me, a lot of it is predictable. You know, it's sort of this formulaic.
Shades of Gray?
Oh, I didn't read it. But, and I don't read a lot of the series and all that, where you sort of know always how it's going to turn out. And the problems that people have are totally implausible. But I resent, to be honest with you, how I am always categorized this way, because I feel like, you know, Chekhov, Virginia Woolf, Hemingway, Faulkner, Salinger, they all wrote in their own voices. Even, do you remember Ring Lardner?
Sure.
I love Ring
Lardner. I never know him personally, but I'm also a fan of his.
Yes. I know you don't know.
No. Well, you say remember him.
No, well, you know, I mean, he hasn't, a lot of people don't know who he is. But, you know, all these people, they write in their own voices, and that pretty much reflect the times and the characters that they're writing about and in their voices. And, you know, I'm doing the same thing, but it's almost as if, because maybe my characters might use profanity, maybe there might be drugs involved, that my characters, and I think sometimes it has to do with because they're black, it's not taken as seriously. And I resent that. I really find it insulting, and I find it racist.
It is. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's a long history of African-American writers being shuttled off and siloed and not taken seriously because they were African-American. They were deemed to be parochial because they were black writers somehow. So therefore, they didn't have the gravitas, or they weren't as much a part of the mainstream by dint of or by light of these kind of reviewers that we're talking about here. And
but I also, I mean, all through high school, college, I never picked up a book and thought, oh, I'm going to read another book by a white author, because there's more about white people that I think I'm missing out on. Or I've never read a book based on someone's ethnicity, for the most part.
You know that great conversation that took place between Toni Morrison and Bill Moyers when he said to her, when are you going to write more toward the center? And she said, you have to come to the center. I'm not the one who's going to the center, you know. We're talking with Terry McMillan. Her new book is Who Asked You? It's a novel. And I'd like to invite those of you who are fans of hers or who are just listening to this conversation and would like to join us to please feel free to do so. Our toll-free number is available to you, and we welcome you into the conversation with any questions or comments you might have. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Again, that number is 866-733-6786. Or email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. But let's hear from you. Join the conversation. She'll be at Rakestraw Books in Danville tonight at 7 p.m. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are with Terry McMillan this hour, and you can be with her, too. That is, you can speak to her, and we welcome your involvement in the program. You can go to our Facebook page or just call us toll-free at 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. And I'm going to go to your calls here forthwith. I just want to talk more about Betty Jean, though, since she's the first character we meet, and she's really, I think, at the emotional heart of the novel. If the novel belongs to anyone, I think it belongs to her. There's a sense of also a woman who I was going to have you maybe read something, but, you know, at one point she says, if I had it to do over, maybe I'd do it with no kids. Or I want to have more to show than just for my life than just a husband and kids. This is really at the heart of probably what a lot of women, particularly of her demographic, feel, I think. And then early on in the novel, says, Lord knows I wish I could have called him baby, about her husband, but the opportunity never presented himself. I wanted my knees to buckle when he touched me, but they always stayed stiff and strong. I wanted my heart to light up and maybe sizzle, but it was a no-show too. I wanted to feel like I couldn't live without him, but I knew I could. Even still, I have enjoyed his company. And boy, that could be a lot of women too. And men. I mean, just what the heart wants and just settling and realizing that one has to accommodate for whatever reasons, or life just makes accommodation necessary.
Well, I think she also, it took a while for her to realize that she did, in fact, love him. But she had a line, and she has a line in here where she says that she just found out that men could end up being just like a household pet. You get used to them and you care about them. Which may seem a little crass, but not in the way she said it. And that's why she made sure that her husband was cared for.
Well, he was cared for. In fact,
I was going to ask you about it.
No, do we not want to go there? Again, I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but the nurse, who's Korean, whose name is Kim, and who's a dish, really, I guess, in the old parlance, and she's having sex with him. I mean, and this could be because he's dementia. I mean, it could be taken as a form of abuse, really, couldn't it?
Well, no, I think he enjoyed it.
I didn't mean to suggest otherwise. But she's also...
I think she felt like she was doing... We're ministering giving too
to
much
him.
Away.
Yeah. No, I don't want to give too much away. But it's kind of a controversial element in the book that
yeah.
you've decided to go there with this...
Look.
More, part of your research?
No, I'm just the conduit. I just thought the way that I created, portrayed her... You know, that she was this hot number. I don't know how she made it through nursing school, but she did. And I just thought that she is the type that would do things behind closed doors, not with malice.
She's looking through their drawers and all that sort of thing. That is the kind of character she is. But she's also likable. I mean,
I liked her a lot. She was funny to me. She cracked me up.
Do you like Quentin? I heard Scott Simon, you were on Weekend Edition. He was asking you a lot about Quentin, the character who's a chiropractor.
I didn't like Quentin that much.
Yeah.
Not initially. He had a little ways to travel in this story.
This is a character who pretty much wants to remove himself, as you said earlier, from his background. Really.
Well, he rejects his blackness to some extent, and he doesn't identify. And he reminds me a lot of what I call Uncle Tom's black people that move into all white neighborhoods and they try to pretend like they're not black or they like being the only black.
You get criticism for this because, you know, you actually even use the word racist. And I remember there was a time when a lot of black people rejected racists. They said, how can you be a racist and be black? It's white people who are in power. They're the ones who are the racists. I mean, that was a part of the rhetoric, especially in, you know, the early militant phases of the SNCC and all the rest of that.
No, they're a black racist.
Yeah, you use the word. But do you get heat from some of your black readers about that?
Not
kind of...
yet.
Oh, okay, just curious.
Not yet.
Let's find out what our callers have to say here. Charles is first up. Good morning.
A very beautiful morning to you, Michael, and to you as well, Miss McMillan. I'm struck about the flow of the conversation because early on in the interview, you were talking about how some black people fall on this whole issue of racism to excuse their own lack of performance. At least that's the way I heard it. And yet, and this is not a criticism, this is only an observation, because, Michael, I think that you are probably one of the few people in the world that I would really like to meet. You do such a good job on your programming. But, again, this is not a criticism, it is only an observation. Later on in your conversation, as you spoke about Terry's experiences in her private life, and particularly the review that was made of one of her books, and you spoke about how you felt that it was racist and from the reviewer. And
I said could have been, I think.
Well, I think you're right, because race in this country, our country, in any objective observation, is probably sickest most on the issue of race, and race as it relates to specifically people of African descent. And some may hear me say this and recognize that, yes, but I am also a man of African descent, so my view is not necessarily all that clear either. And I would concede that there probably is some of that in me as well. I just want to say to Ms. McMillan, forget these closed-minded, narrow-minded people who can't see beyond their own ethnic noses. And your work is outstanding on its own. It's not Faulknerian. It doesn't need to be validated by being compared to Faulkner or anybody else. Your work stands for itself, and I just wanted to call and say that.
Well, I appreciate it.
And thank you, Charles. And we'll get Razab on, next caller. Good morning.
Morning, Michael. My question for Terry is one of a sort of a writing perspective. As an author, I am amazed at her ability to describe, to get in the mind of sick people and describe their thought process in such a coherent manner that you almost find yourself identifying with it. And in real life, she's nothing, you know, she's well-adjusted as far as we know. I just wanted to understand how you do it. How do you do it so well?
Well, thank you for saying that. You know, I initially choose characters that have problems and issues that I find either intolerable or I have very little respect for or very little patience for. Or I want to know, I'm just curious about how they do, how they live the way they live. Why do they live this way? And so in order to do that, I really have to not exist. And I create profiles of these characters, really, really extensive profiles, and such that I know so much about them that they do become real, even though a lot of the things that I know about them, I don't necessarily use in the story. But I take them very seriously, as well as their problems and the issues that they are going to confront, because I basically ask them, you know, what's the biggest hurdle that you are trying to get over right now?
You interview them.
Pretty much.
Effect, yeah.
And I write it down and I find out what that is. And that's the very first thing that I make them deal with. But I learn that we all have shortcomings. And life is hard.
Well, you have compassion for your characters,
yes,
too, don't you?
I have to say the compassion angle, Michael, is true. Because when I was reading Bluest Eye, the way she was describing this sick guy, I was like, oh, my God, I'm thinking like him. This is too good. So, but a lot of work goes in. Thank you. I mean, that definitely helps guide us.
Thank you, Razab.
Thank you very much.
Good to hear from you. Another thing, do you know the writer? Actually, he's from here originally, but lived in Louisiana most of his life as a child, Ernest Gaines.
I know of him. I don't know him.
No, I just wondered if you'd read his work, because he does something really quite exceptional and unusual. It's almost virtuosity that you do. Gets us in the mind of a kid and uses a kid's voice. I mean, Luther, the boy, well, there are two boys. There's Luther and Ricky. And it's just a wonderful touch, for example, when Luther gets scared of broccoli. Those kinds of things, because he's not been exposed to many vegetables, but actually seeing through his eyes and hearing his voice, that sounds real.
I love reading his chapters.
That's tough to do, though. I mean, it's one thing to get into a white woman's head and talk, or a black man's head or whatever, but to do a kid is really very challenging. I know writers who've tried it and just ultimately failed. Jennifer writes, I read Who Asked You last week and loved it. It's funny. She mentioned Faulkner earlier. Actually, I did. But anyway, the new book has a very Faulkner-esque feeling to it. I also heard that A Day Late and A Dollar Short is going to be a movie starring Whoopi Goldberg. Did she have anything to do with the movie?
Not really. I just was I was asked if I would approve certain actors, and plus the script, which was written by a woman from Canada. And it was really well done. I liked it a lot. A lot. But that's pretty much it. They just, you know, they just ask, you know, how do you feel about this, Terry? And that's as far. I don't want to get involved.
Here's a listener who says, wait, wanting to be reviewed as a writer and have your personal life disregarded? You did a borderline Jerry Springer-esque confrontation with your ex-husband on Oprah. What did you expect the Times reviewer to do?
That was about, first of all, what she said about me had nothing to do with her reviewing my book. My book was being reviewed, not my personal life. And the two are not, they shouldn't even be compared. I mean, if she knew some of the things that goes on with thousands of other writers' personal lives, if reviewers had to put things that happen in their lives into a review, I mean, just imagine. But it wasn't Jerry Springer, and I resent this person for saying it. And part of what happened was it was my fame that was on display. And basically, I was trying to make clear that I was a victim of all kinds of abuse. And I didn't appreciate. And that's what I went on the show to do. And it turned out that it ended up being something else. Hence why I was a little struck by some of the questions as well as Jonathan's answers. But I don't have to apologize for anything. I did it the way I wanted to do it. And, you know, the bottom line is this reviewer had no right to invade my personal life and put it on display. In the context of reviewing my book, I thought it was crass. I thought it was childish and irresponsible and just plain tacky.
Also brings up a fascinating question, though, and one that literary people, mea culpa, which I am, you know, wrestle with a lot. How much do you separate the life from the work, or how much should you separate the life from the work? And, you know, I always think about Proust, who said, you know, there should be no resemblance at all, of complete separation and all that. But I'm thinking about what's going on now with Salinger. You know, a lot has been dug out about his personal life, which he tried to keep very private, of course, spent a whole lifetime making it private. And some of it is is really quite contemptible. I mean, you know, going for young girls and trying to essentially...
I know one of those young girls.
Well, we both probably know the same girl.
Yep.
But the fact of the matter is, you know, people are saying, why... You know, people say the artist is important with Salinger, and they'll put Salinger in this kind of special category. But they won't with Terry McMillan. And maybe it's a commercial success of your work. Not to say that Catcher in the Rye wasn't one of the biggest commercial successes of all time. But again, there's that looking at him as the artist, maybe not looking at you as the artist.
You know, I don't know. But, I mean, this is only one person. And then this caller, you know, I mean, people have... they have their own preconceived image of what a writer is, how they're supposed to act publicly. But a lot of writers never get to be in public. They're never on Oprah Winfrey or the Today Show or Good Morning America. A lot of them don't get that chance. And so on some levels, your fame can be used against you. And... you know, I mean, I've never experienced anything like this. You know, I just like to sit in my house quietly and tell stories and lie for a living. and so when people start judging you personally, I'm like, wait a minute, this is separate from what I do.
This reviewer went even beyond that, though. She suggested that somehow what happened to you in your personal life was disappointing to your readers because they were so strongly identified with you.
No, she thought that my readers read my books and they, too, decided to try to find themselves a boy toy.
Yeah.
But she basically insulted them, too.
That's exactly what I meant, yeah.
Yeah.
Let me bring another caller
but
on.
Whatever.
Here's Jean from Alameda. Jean, hi.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you, Michael, for having Terry on. Terry, you and your books have been near and dear to my heart for a long time. And the reason why I like you so much and I love your books is because you keep it real. And when you write, you strike a nerve to people's heart. And it's really, really great to talk to you. It's a real honor. And I wanted to ask you, the sequel
Thank
to
you.
Waiting to Exhale is there going to be a movie? Because of all your books, I have to say that was my favorite. And thank you for all you do. And it's such an honor to talk to you.
Thank you very much. I don't know yet what the status is on the sequel. Since Whitney passed away, you know, the studios, they wanted to redo the film without that character in it. And that's when I sort of just dropped out.
And since we're talking about personal life, did you get to know Whitney Houston much through your association with
her? I mean, not on a very personal yeah. level, but I know. No, I mean, we didn't call each other on
the phone. It struck me as such
a
tragic story of such an immense talent.
It is a tragic story.
We're talking again with Terry McMillan, and her new book is Who Asked You? And in the time remaining, if you'd like to join us, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And here's a listener who writes on the website, in the media that's targeted at the African-American community, like the movies where 9 out of 10 actors are black, what is the function of glamour manifested as bling, bragging, expensive lifestyles, and jobs? Does it help blacks find something to aspire to, or does it have a corrupting influence that keeps blacks down?
I think for the most part, there are two different schools here. One is fueled by and serviced by the streets, which is where a lot of the whole bling and the hip hop thing sort of is. It's part of the engine, and on some levels, I find it's all also part of this whole why so many people are like fame whores or fame junkies. Everybody wants to be rich. Everybody wants to be famous. Everybody wants to be glamorous, and it's like this ongoing competition for attention, sort of like Ted Cruz.
He's still talking while we're speaking.
I know he is. But on the other hand, you have people that, and I'm not saying that they aren't making a contribution, but on some levels, I think some of what they are striving for is so superficial, it's almost sad. And that's why I think on some levels, so much is going on in Chicago. It's gang related, but it's still about money and it's about drugs and it's about power. And it's a false sense of power. And I think on the other hand, you have people that do things in the community that are trying to help improve things on whatever level. And to me, that's what I do writing. It's my own way. I don't want to say it's an act of charity, but it's my own way of showing respect for those of us who are struggling and trying to find our way in this society on a much more positive level. And when that doesn't happen, I try to show that too, why it's not happening. You know, so if you fall prey to the streets and you end up in prison, you can blame the white man if you want to, but also you have to accept some responsibility for your own behavior. And I would much rather be an asset than a liability.
We go to another caller. This is Shabazz from Oakland. Hi, Shabazz.
Hey, how you doing today? I wanted to just kind of make a comment. I think that in the time we live in where there's so much black-on-black crime, you know, over the 4th of July holiday, we had 60-some people getting shot up in Chicago, and we all just heard about the 13, 14 dozen people getting shot up in Chicago as well, and Oakland, California, where I'm from. And it's just like, you know, these are like microcosm about what's happening on the whole wide scene across the nation. And with so many professional authors, you know, such as Ms. McMillan and others who are professional writers, you know, I think this is a time where we could use people who could write. And I'm a Jack Lick writer myself, you know.
You're a what?
I just say I'm a jackleg. I'm a writer as well, you know.
Oh.
And I have a book out called New Leadership into the 21st Century. And we address a lot of these issues, you know, and solutions to them. So I think it would be good if writers could get together and talk about solutions to these problems and where have we dropped the ball at and what can be done about it, and people who are influential writers and philosophers and thinkers, if we could come together and discuss these issues and put papers out on them or put books out on them, then I think that we could begin to curtail some of this violence that we're experiencing so much.
So forgive me, Shabazz, what I'm hearing you say is you'd like African-American writers like Ms. McMillan to pool their resources and come up with some solutions. But not necessarily
get with other people who get with other writers you know, and discuss the issues.
Yeah.
Well, I hear what you're saying, but that's first of all, I think that what I do is paint pictures of human behavior, and in my case, African American behavior. And sometimes by painting a picture, you get a chance to see what the results and the impact of that behavior is. I could be didactic and preach and tell you what I think we should do, but that's not what I do.
There's been a long, and Shabazz, thank you for the call. Battle goes back probably to Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, or up forward to Ralph Ellison and Richard Wright in terms of art and literature being didactic as opposed to just telling stories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you take the side of the storytelling, I mean, the painting pictures.
But you can still paint a picture. If you show someone who is violent or does things that, you know, especially black-on-black crime, which is a real big one for me right now. And I even put on Twitter, I wish that a lot of these young brothers would read the autobiography of Malcolm X. That could help. But I don't know. There is no panacea. There is no one thing that we can do to solve all of our problems. And I think that all of us as artists and politicians and service people, whatever, that there are people out here that are addressing these issues, but there is no one thing that we can all do to make other people see. You cannot make other people change their behavior unless they want to change it. And first, they have to acknowledge that what they're doing is negative.
Stan, let's hear from you next. Thanks for waiting. You're on.
Thank you for taking my call, Mr. McMillan. Fantastic interview. You've impressed me so much today that I'm going to go get your book and read it.
Thank you.
And I had called up just to thank you for not apologizing. I'm tired of the empty apologies that people don't deserve or to have to give to a public that it's really none of their business. And thank you for having the integrity to say, no, I don't owe anybody an apology. I'm very impressed with that. But listening, I become more impressed as the son of a civil rights leader who was taken down and a white one at that, for you to be exposing a lot of the hypocrisy in the civil rights movement right now. And I really love that you are focusing us on a good future, a positive future target, as opposed to asking people to continue to dwell in a negative past.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stan. Well, you want to hear another negative comment?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Listener writes, an annoying conversation with an annoying author. I got as far in a one book of McMillan's until her female character, upon being left for a white woman, flew into a racist screed. I would have similar trouble reading a book with a similar passage with the races reversed. And to hear husbands described as pets, sure, that relationship dynamic happens with any combination of genders. But would a male writer's description of wives as pets be chuckled about on KQED? He's taking us both to task, I think, there. Want to respond?
No.
No, okay.
I don't want to respond.
We'll go on to another caller then. Roger, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. My name is Roger, and I'm old. I'm 76. I grew up on the streets of San Francisco. My father was murdered when I was 7. My mother wandered off in alcoholic days. I supported myself on the streets by stealing, burglary, etc. But I did graduate from high school, and then I went on to college, San Francisco State, and then got two postgraduate degrees. Mm-hmm. Am I influenced by the streets? Absolutely. In every part of my life, I am influenced. But they don't write about people like us, men or women, who really, you know, who survive and do fairly well.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, there are people writing about you and people like you, Roger. Rest assured. Thank you for the call. Terry McMillan will be at Rakestraw Books in Danville tonight at 7, and tomorrow 6:30. She'll be in Oakland at the Heart and Soul Center of Light for a talk and signing, which is sponsored by Marcus Books. And so good to have had you on. Appreciate your being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
And good luck with the new book. The book, again, is Who Asked You?, a novel by New York Times bestselling author of Waiting to Exhale, Terry McMillan. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us forum@kqed.org or going to our website. You can continue this conversation on our website as well. It's kqed.org/forum. And want to let you know who is behind the scenes here, as we try to do in every program. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, with engagement producer being Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. We'll be with you if all goes according to plan on tomorrow. We're going to talk in this hour tomorrow about concussions and new concussion research, particularly in light of the big settlement with the NFL and the Players Association. Thank you again for all of us here at KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.